For more information about Ancient Dragon Zen Gate and Tygon's teaching, please visit us at ancientdragon.org. Judging from your introduction, you wouldn't think that I would ever be bored. But I am actually going to talk to you all about boredom today. And some of you may walk away with firsthand knowledge of this, but actually what I want to talk to you about is the gift of boredom, that I think as part of our practice, boredom can actually be a gift, and hopefully you'll also walk away with maybe a sense of that at the end of my talk. And so I hit on this topic through my own personal experience. I caught myself recently expressing the fear that someone might be bored, you know, in my presence, or might find me boring, or, you know, might have that experience with me. And I started exploring this fear on a personal level, and, you know, where does that come from? But while I was exploring that in the context of my life and my own personal history and my own personal fears, it also occurred to me that this is really not unique to me. That I think maybe especially in our culture, this is a fear that everybody has. And what I mean by that is, I think, you know, boredom is a very, very stigmatized experience in our culture. We should never be boring, you know, along with like bad breath and smelly feet. These are things that we just should never ever do, and we should never be bored. You know, it's something that we, I think, you know, we kind of experience as unpleasant in some way. And people have sort of thoughts about what it means to be bored. I kind of wanted to start off by asking that question. You know, what does it mean to be bored? There's no particular right answer, but what are different aspects of being bored?
Gary.
Disconnected.
Okay, so you're kind of disconnected from your experience or what's going on. You feel out of joint.
Impatience.
You could. So that's something that comes up as an aspect of boredom, feeling like, got to get out of this.
Nadav. I think probably related, but distraction.
Distraction, yeah.
Some sort of distraction.
I think we maybe sort of try to grasp on for some distraction or kind of reach out for that. I'm going to talk about that in a sec. Anything else quickly come to mind?
Aimlessness or pointlessness.
It feels like what are we doing here? Any thoughts about what it means to be boring or what that experience feels like? When you feel like I myself am boring, or even just this is boring. Laurel.
So last night I was with my nephew and niece who are 7 and 9, and I felt boring with them. I just couldn't quite connect with them. Like what was? I thought we were going to do something fun, but I think they were bored with
me. You didn't maybe meet their conditions for what fun includes. Okay.
It was really hard.
So it was hard, too. It was hard. It felt, yeah, it was something, when you say hard, I think I sometimes hear painful.
Yeah, so I was striving to connect, but missing the mark.
Yeah.
The harder I tried, the worse it got.
Oh, I'm sorry. Feel free to play this for them anytime. Maybe when they're a little older. other things, Will?
When I look back and think, oh, that was a time when I was boring, it's often the time where I felt like I got a little wrapped up in myself. I think, oh, I was boring because I was really excited about this thing that was happening with me or this thing that I really cared about, and I lost track of the fact that the people around me didn't care so much about it. And I feel kind of selfishness leads to being bored.
That's great. You were kind of separated from your audience for a time and noticed it. And
noticed it after the fact.
Yeah, couldn't correct it maybe in time. But I think you're kind of also pointing out an aspect, which is that we really sort of almost unconsciously try to align things and try to connect and try to, you know, manage this experience. Any other quick thoughts, Nathan?
Someone said that
feeling bored is like feeling that something is pointless.
Uh-huh.
Maybe feeling boring is feeling like you're pointless.
Yeah.
Or what you have to say is pointless.
Yeah, okay. Mm-hmm. That it has no relevance or worth, even. Thanks. So along with boredom and being boring or feeling bored, we do things, you know, again, almost automatically to push it away. What, anybody want to just sort of say some things that we tend to do to push away boredom? I've got a whole list. So. Josh, you're kind of laughing.
Angry Birds.
I think I know what this is.
It's a stupid game on my phone.
Yeah. Perfect. I play Sudoku on my phone. Yeah. It tells me how long I've been playing it for. In weeks. I'm going to have to get that. I probably shouldn't get that one. No. Other things that we do to push away boredom. Nadav.
I have this habit with news. I'm like kind of a news junkie, and somehow there's a sense that it's somehow important, so I can excuse the kind of the, you know, the addiction.
Thanks for saying the word addiction, because I was thinking about how boredom can really play a part in our addictions, because addictions tend to be something that we reach for almost unthinkingly, and boredom is something that we really push away without even thinking about it. It's just ingrained that this should not be happening. Mm. Other things? Hi, I don't know your name.
I'm Katrina.
Hi, Katrina.
I like to either eat or think about how I shouldn't be eating.
Great, another addiction. I mean, we all need to eat, but when we know that we're eating because we're bored, then we know that we've lapsed into something. Something slightly different. Thanks. Joan.
Find something to read.
Yeah. That was the joke that I had with almost everyone that I told about this talk the week before was, you know, you might want to bring a book. I'll be talking about boredom. So, one thing that I notice sometimes that nobody said is talking, you know, just talking, just finding, we find anything and everything to talk about, and maybe, you know, just calling a friend or mindlessly doing something, picking a fight with someone else, doing something to, you know, sometimes I think people, you know, flirt out of boredom or, you know, do something to raise the excitement level. You know, something feels like we're having a lull. We got to do something to raise the excitement level, get rid of this. And so I guess one thing that I'm taking away from this is that everyone is familiar with boredom. We all understand the concept. And so I thought that I wanted to talk about some Buddhist thoughts on boredom and thinking about boredom from how we can practice this. And the first thing that I thought of the second thing I thought of is I didn't bring my watch with me. So if you could tell me when we're getting...
Okay, you have
time. The first thing I thought of is from the Theravadan tradition, the concept of the five hindrances. And these are thought to be, the Theravadan tradition is considered to be some of the oldest and original teachings from the Buddha. And the Theravadan tradition in particular, I think, tends to focus on one's own personal spiritual development, one's own personal enlightenment. And the five hindrances are basically sort of categories of obstacles that might block the road to spiritual progress. And they would consist of, you know, the first one would be sensual desire for experience or sense experience. Second one would be ill will or aversion. The third is sloth and torpor. The fourth is restlessness. And the fifth is skeptical doubt. And in particular, as I was doing a little research about this, you don't hear boredom anywhere explicitly on this list, but as I did a little research, I saw that boredom was mentioned as a facet of each of the three middle ones. It's a part, it's related to ill will or aversion, it relates to sloth and torpor, and it relates to restlessness. And so I thought I would talk about each of those experiences and how boredom relates to this. And so with ill will or aversion, boredom is thought to be an aspect of this because it can be seen to arise as a seemingly involuntary response to something that we want to push away. And seemingly, I think maybe is the operative word, that when we take a closer look at boredom, it might reveal that it is really based on a judgment that we've actually made about our experience as unwanted or uncomfortable. You know, we're it's almost automatic where we say, you know, oh, I don't like this, and this is boring. And I think it's been, you know, sort of said that we sort of shut down our energy when we get bored. Just, you know, I'm not going to devote any more energy to this experience. And so, you know, boredom can represent sort of a turning away from experience without really thinking about it directly. And so one of the antidotes that they prescribe for boredom is that it, you know, can be dispelled by opening to our experience, by cultivating sort of a compassionate acceptance towards what's going on. And so trying to counter that a little bit with maybe just a little bit more of a welcoming kind of sense. And something to, you know, just noticing our aversion, noticing what we're doing with it, just sort of accepting that, maybe trying to notice what it is that we're trying to push away. So, sloth and torpor is actually two of my favorite words in this talk. And because it's like, you know, we kind of hear them and it just sounds like deadly sins, but I'm going to actually define them. Sloth, I had to look these up because we think, you know, you think you know what they mean, but I really wanted to know. And sloth was actually defined as a spiritual or emotional apathy. One of the synonyms was the word acedia, which someone gave a talk about one time, and it's just, you know, we're just sort of spiritually and emotionally bleh. And torpor actually is a state of temporarily decreased physiological and mental activity. So it's kind of speaks to the energy level going down in our bodies. And so sloth and torpor relates to sort of an experience of sleepiness or dullness, which may have to do with our experience of boredom. Personally, I think that boredom is probably most related to this particular state. Although, you know, what I tend to experience it as is just sleepy, you know, just... That's something that I personally struggle with a lot in sitting, that I just sort of, you know, whoa, what's happening? Now, they do sort of say that in some cases we really may just be sleepy, that, you know, the chronic excitement and tension that I think maybe in, you know, in our culture and those of us who are sort of like living in the world and our day-to-day lives, the chronic excitement and tension that we are experiencing every day may really lead to weariness, and it may be difficult to see how deeply, deeply fatigued you are until you sit down. And sometimes I think that is, you know, what's going on with me. But I've also noticed, though, that sometimes, you know, as I practice with that feeling, and it doesn't go away, you know, if I take a nap or if I drink a cup of coffee or, you know, something. Sometimes, though, I think it can be caused by, you know, the same sort of resistance or unwillingness to feel something or to be somewhere. I recently was on a 3-week meditation intensive, and I wanted to be there. I did. You know, I chose to be there, and I wanted to be there, but I, for the first couple days, I really experienced a feeling of, I don't want to leave my life at home. You know, I had traveled across the country and flown there, and I really was ready. On one level, I was ready to immerse myself. But on the other hand, there were some wonderful things going on in my life, and I just didn't want to be there. And I did not want to pull my thoughts away from that and be present where I was. It was just like, no, I still really want to think about this. And you know, I think that's maybe on a more subtle level an inclination that we all have all the time. It's like, oh no, that juicy thought just went by and I still want it. I'm unwilling to just be here with whatever's going on. As I was reading, I came across a number of accounts that I don't actually believe, but a number of people said that they believe that, you know, meditation itself is inherently designed to be boring, and, you know, that sort of long periods of practice are inherently designed to be boring so that we can work with that experience. I don't know, you know, I don't know that I really believe that is true, but it does give us a chance to observe, you know, what's going on and what it is that we are trying to grasp towards. You know, I think that it's really true that nothing is inherently boring. You know, something that I might consider really boring, you know, a boring lecture or something, Eric might be totally interested in. And so I'm sitting there going, oh my God, when is this over? And, you know, you might be going, oh, this is great. They're talking about, you know, my favorite subject. Boredom is really an activity of our mind. It's an activity of our willingness to engage. And, I think, you know, Gary first said disconnection. It's our boredom is, you know, kind of our unwillingness to connect with an experience or a person or sort of what's going on right now. You know, it's kind of in the eye of the beholder. So it's not that something is boring, although, you know, we may be bored. And, you know, in particular, I think boredom can be a sign that the conditions that you require of your life are not being met right now. One example that I read was one of, you know, people who need to feel that others are sort of, you know, enhancing and reflecting their self-image may feel really bored when others do not respond in that way, when they're not getting that reflection of, yeah, you know, you're so great or fascinating. It could feel like, well, this is boring. I don't really want to be here now. I don't want to attend to this experience that doesn't meet my conditions for how I need things to be. And so, you know, in terms of working with that, things that I read kind of talk about how, you know, similar to practicing with aversion, boredom that's related to sloth and torpor can be dispelled through investigation. You know, you don't have to struggle against it. That doesn't tend to help. But there are ways that you can find to, you know, kind of arouse energy as you're practicing. And one that they talk about is, you know, looking up, using energizing postures. Sometimes sometimes this works. If you are sitting and, you know, facing the wall and really feeling, you know, kind of your energy level just sinking. Sometimes it helps to just, you know, raise your gaze a little bit. Just, you know, you don't have to move anything, but just look upwards a little bit. And similarly, it can help to increase what they call mental noting, you know, just paying attention to each moment of your experience and really just trying to get precise about, okay, having a feeling of heaviness or having a feeling of, you know, kind of fuzziness around the corners of the insides of my eyes, notice wherever you feel that sensation. Also talk about using walking meditation as a way of continuing to maintain your focus while doing something to, you know, reconnect with at least your blood flow and your energy flow. Also exploring the subjective experience of boredom, you know, kind of like I was just saying, the physical feelings of heaviness and dullness, explore where you feel them, where they, you know, see if you can observe them changing. But also observing your mental judgments and beliefs. What might be contributing to this experience right now? What, you know, even sometimes it's like a sort of a, what isn't here right now? I'm feeling really sort of a nothing feeling. What is it that I think isn't here right now? And finally, they just really recommend, you know, don't give up in the face of difficult experience. Just do the best you can. Having a, for me, having this particular experience of, you know, torpor especially is really difficult. And it's not how I feel like my meditation should be going. And I feel like this does feel like one that I want to get out of here. And sometimes getting out of here might involve saying, okay, I'm only going to sit for, you know, 20 minutes instead of 30, or, you know, 10 minutes instead of 20. And what they really recommend is don't just give up, you know, do the best you can. You really may need to change some things, but you can really, really learn something, I think, from, you know, working with this experience and just sort of seeing what it is. And so finally, the third hindrance that seems most directly related to boredom to me is restlessness. And I think, you know, restlessness, as people were kind of pointing out, can arise as we attempt to avoid boredom. That, you know, ironically, it's almost like a cycle. Boredom comes from trying to push something away, and then we try to push that away, you know, by picking a fight or stirring up excitement. And so I think actually, you know, boredom can be seen to result from sort of the continuous shifting of desire, you know, the lack of ability to calm the mind. You know, I want this, and then you get that, and then it's like, oh no, I want this, and then you get that, it's, oh, I want this. Or, you know, even in practicing, it's like, oh, I want this, and you try to observe that and calm it down, and then you get, you know, whoa, wait a minute, this is like nothing, I don't want that. You know, then you push that away. It's like, it can really be part of this sort of, you know, cycle of endless craving and grasping and pushing away. And what is recommended as an antidote for this is, you know, you can overcome this through allowing ourselves to observe ourselves without attaching, without pushing away, or without trying to satisfy desire. You know, in talking about, you know, sensual desire, it's really, you know, it's really continuous. You know, it's really sort of inexhaustible. We will continue to reach out for one thing or another. And sometimes we can think that, you know, oh, that thing is a trigger for me. Whether it's, you know, Cheetos or, you know, chocolate cake, or, you know, we'll try to sort of strike a bargain with the thing that tends to be a particular trigger. And actually in sort of thinking about this, what they recommend is actually just working with the desire, you know, in yourself, just trying to work with sort of uprooting desire, or weakening it, maybe is a better word. That ultimately, you know, we try to weaken the cycle of greed and hate and delusion. Almost, you know, I would kind of want to say almost like just learning to relax with it, you know, and not feeling like we need to do something about it, but just observing. Okay, here we go again. Here, you know. There's my craving for Cheetos again, or, you know, there's my dislike of, you know, honking car horns or something. So, I guess I'm about to sort of shift a little, and what I want to, you know, say about this is that it seems like this sort of discussion of greed, or of boredom, as an aspect of, you know, really sort of a cycle of greed, hate, and desire, is very helpful in, you know, helpful in seeing the roots of our experience as we relate to boredom as a phenomenon, I guess. You know, you can kind of, that's what I get mostly from the Theravadin discussion, that boredom is a state, you know, it's a phenomenon, and it's a, you know, aspect of experience. But I think what I have a little bit of a reaction to in this kind of discussion is that the discussion itself seems to contain some element of pushing it away. That, you know, when we use words like hindrance, or, you know, dispel, or overcome, there's something about it that's like, well, this shouldn't be happening. you know, so we almost like you've got to do something about boredom. And I think that boredom seems to hold a deeper question, you know, or probably a lot of deeper questions. But one that comes to mind for me is, what is it that you don't want to face? You know, there's something happening here that I don't want to have happening. And so in thinking about approaching boredom from a Zen perspective, I sort of hit on thinking about a particular koan. And the one that came to me is Ordinary Mind is the Way, which is case 19 in the Mumon Kan, or the Gateless Gate. And I'm gonna read it to you, and then I'll start talking. And I probably, everybody, even if you aren't familiar with particular koans, are familiar with what they are. You know, they're kind of a teaching poem that tends to be sort of paradoxical. You can't really understand it with, you know, our regular discursive mind. And I think, you know, everybody's familiar with, you know, what is the sound of one hand clapping. And this is another really good one. And it is a dialogue between a teacher and a student. And both of these individuals became very, very, very famous teachers. Zhaozhou and his teacher Nanchuan. And I'll just read you the dialogue. Zhaozhou earnestly asked Nanchuan, "What is the way?" And Nanchuan answered, "The ordinary mind is the way." And Zhaozhou asked, "Should I direct myself toward it or not?" And Nanchuan said, "If you try to turn toward it, you go against it." So Zhaozhou then asked, "If I do not try to turn toward it, how can I know that it is the way?" And Nanchuan answered, "The way does not belong to knowing or not knowing. Knowing is delusion. Not knowing is a blank consciousness. When you have really reached the true way beyond all doubt, you will find it as vast and boundless as the great empty sky. How can it be talked about on a level of right and wrong?" And at these words, Zhaozhou was suddenly enlightened. So he's wondering, you know, what is the way? And he hears that the ordinary mind is the way. And so he immediately thinks, I got to do something about that. You know, that I do remember that was, I didn't know this koan, but I remember when I first sat, the feeling was like, really? Really? There's got to be something here. It's got to be something more than this. And there is, you know, there is. But if you try to turn toward it, you go against it. So, you know, if I do not try to turn toward it, how can I know that it is the way? And I guess the way does not belong to knowing or not knowing. And I'll come back to this in a minute. You know, and I think I've mentioned koans when I've given talks before and sort of said that it's possible to understand them in many different ways. There's no really one right understanding or right or wrong, because the way does not belong to right or wrong. But you can really kind of apply them to your life, and that is one way to work with this, is see, you know, what's going on in your life, and almost like, you know, remembering a song lyric because it, you know, it relates to what's going on right now. Sometimes these things come up. And so I think, you know, you can apply this koan to boredom and maybe bring both the experience of boredom and the koan to life in a new way. So, you know, while it's true that ordinary mind is the way, you know, I think that we need to practice in order to bring something that transforms our ordinary experience. You know, while ordinary mind is, you know, involves our ordinariness, you know, our delusion and our greed, hate and delusion in particular, it's not, you know, it's not just that. It's we can't just mindlessly act that cycle out, you know? That actually, I think what practice can involves is bringing our awareness to it. One of the things that I learned on my meditation intensive was that all, you know, we are deluded beings. We are, the activity of our minds is deluded activity. And so it can be kind of confusing as you think about, you know, what is the way? How do I deal with my ordinary mind? Do I direct myself towards it or not? How do I deal with this deluded mind and its deluded activity by bringing more deluded activity to it? You know, we can't exactly ever fully step out of that cycle. We are limited beings, but bringing actually compassionate awareness of our experience to what's happening actually transforms that, and it cultivates Buddha and it cultivates enlightenment. It's not that we have to do something, but just continue to welcome that experience and investigate it, and allow boredom to be boredom. We can maybe ask ourselves questions like, what is this? Is this it? Or even maybe something more specific as we start to notice different aspects of this, like, what am I afraid of? What is it that I don't want here? So investigation in a sort of sense of relaxing with it and welcoming it, rather than, without the idea of making it go away. I think that, it's certainly not my place to predict what you will find in practicing boredom, but I think that it might be true that, facing boredom is really facing yourself, that there's a whole, whole worlds are there in just that one experience. We talk about Zen as being, the experience of intimacy with oneself and intimacy with one's experience and intimacy with the world. And I think boredom can actually be an experience of intimacy. Ordinary mind is the way, and it may contain in its list of ingredients desire, ill will, sloth and torpor, restlessness, doubt, boredom. There's really no need to direct yourself towards it, because it's coming at you all the time. Just bring some awareness to it of, what is this? What is this that's showing up right now? There is a capping verse to this koan that I particularly like, and the verse is, "The spring flowers, the moon in autumn, the cool breezes of summer, the winter's snow. If idle concerns do not cloud the mind, this is man's happiest season." Or, as Taigen has said sometimes when we've talked about this koan, every day is a good day. If idle concerns do not cloud the mind, every day is a good day. When we are not pulled around by grasping and avoiding, then we naturally actually begin to appreciate ourselves as we are, and we appreciate our friends and family as they are, even in the boring moments, and not so much as we would like them to be, but just letting them be the way they are. Turning away from our emotions and our relationships towards something that we think is spiritually grander is actually turning away from the way. So I think, what I came away from my own excursion of thought with this is the idea that there is no need to try to make boredom interesting. Just let it be boring. I read a lot about how, if we can explore this aspect of boredom, it can actually become fascinating. And I was sort of like, yeah, right. I don't think you can, there are some things that I don't think you can ever truly make fascinating. And why do you need to? I think that the gift of allowing boredom to be boredom and just, relaxing with that can really help us to more fully appreciate our lives. And so I think that's probably where I want to end, but I hope that you are now having a feeling of like, okay, I want to check this out. and not so much like, oh, not another boring, 30-minute sitting period. So we have some time, and I'm hoping that we could have a really boring discussion about this. If anyone wants to be so brave. Deborah.
It's a very timely topic for me because I've been thinking quite a bit about it. I'm retiring soon, and the comments I often get is, well, how wonderful, you must have lots of plans. And I realize I've been resisting that because I have a sense if I jump into things, I'll be bored in boredom, and that I want to be able to explore different facets of that, of whatever will happen, which may be boredom.
Yeah, that's great.
What that will be like before I move into things that feel like they're right for me. Mm-hmm.
Thanks, yeah. How do you feel going into that?
Well, I realize there's some fear on it.
Yeah. It's like, I'm so happy you were willing to say that. Thanks.
Fear of being disconnected, fear of depression. Because I don't know that I've experienced a lot of boredom in my life.
Yeah.
And, but I think my aspect, it's changing somewhat in that I'm having some curiosity as much as dread.
That's wonderful. It's such a great example, because it's really sort of, you know, what our culture sort of propels us towards, and yet then, you know, there's this idea that it should be completely full and, you know, never unsatisfying.
I just really like your talk. I really appreciate, in particular, the point that which I'd never. It never come to me before, but this idea of I've always thought of boredom as this kind of neutral, you know, blah, just not a noteworthy state. And it seems like your talk really introduces the idea that it's like a really, really kind of pressing or witnessing of this sort of fundamental kind of aggression we bring to our own experience. This has got to be different.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
It's so, thank you.
Well, you're welcome. Logged a lot of hours on that.
Something came to me while you were speaking, and I don't know what to make of it really, but I was wondering if people wanted to comment. On the fact that I think we use boredom in many contexts as a punishment, actually. I watched my aunt put my young cousin into a serious timeout one time. What did that consist of? Sit and look at a wall for 5 full minutes. What does this mean?
Yeah. Huh, you know, prison, you know, doing time.
The experience of boredom is one of the things that I have a hard time talking about when people say, oh, you meditate, so that's great. It's really relaxing and calm. Right? You go, well, maybe that first 20 minutes, but maybe not. You know, and that's a challenge a lot of times when people come and say, oh, you're going to learn zazen, and it's going to be very relaxing and calming. And we kind of go, well, maybe and maybe not. There might be other things you could do instead. But, you know, it is kind of designed that there's nothing happening that's entertaining. And as you said, your body, your mind is a craving machine. It wants to be entertained. It wants something out there to get it engaged. And if there isn't anything there, it's going to feel this incredible boredom. It's just, no.
Yeah.
This is not acceptable. Just go get out of this and find something else to do. Or you'll start fantasizing about something that happened that upset you or worried you or that you want or that made you mad or that could happen. None of that's particularly relaxing until maybe you kind of keep sitting with it, and it'll maybe calm down and then come back.
Yeah. You know, nowhere did I see anyone describe boredom as, you know, getting in touch with an aspect of emptiness. But I do kind of wonder if that is part of it. You know, that we experience emptiness for a moment and then we rush to bring something in. You know, just kind of proving that whole theorem about nature abhorring a vacuum. It's like our minds are like, whoa, get something in there. But yeah.
I think it's a, you know, kind of key if you're talking to people, unlike in your discussion here, if you're talking to a room of people, you can watch it happen. If you've gone on too long about a topic or it's just not interesting, you watch people just, you know, they go elsewhere, right? And you can watch it happen. It's clearly people just sort of becoming disengaged from what's going on right there because it's just not entertaining enough.
Yeah, it's not meeting their criteria or requirements. Sure. Hey, Don.
Thank you very much for the talk. You know, I find when I'm at home alone, which isn't all that often, but then I'm like, okay. So I have my dining room table that we don't even eat at anymore because I've got all this stuff. Like, you know, taxes, you know, I've got that, you know, piles of stuff to do. But I choose to be bored. You know, my house is a wreck. But I'm choosing to be bored and sit on that couch and go, man, this sucks. Because I don't want to do the other stuff that also sucks. That I just, you know, and I'm like, I gotta be bored and like not, and just like sit here and like, and dwell on the fact that I've got other stuff over there that also, and so I think that that's not so healthy, but I haven't figured out, you know, I haven't gotten, you know, but so it was interesting to hear that, and I, you know, I've heard other people talk about putting things off, and maybe, you know, that's, I'm putting things off, I'm pushing things off, and definitely not, you know, taking care of businesses.
Well, it sounds like you're having a feeling too that my life should be optimal somehow. I should be doing this. I should be mindfully doing the dishes.
Maybe, you know, it is like that, but it's something like that, you know. And I try not to use that kind of language because I've been taught well, I've been trained well, but for that part of it. But yeah, I'm definitely like sitting there looking at
piles. Yeah,
I'd rather just sit here and be bored. But yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I really appreciated your talk and accept that maybe it wasn't boring enough. It was very stimulating. But just a couple of different responses. One is, I remember when I first started practicing and going to Sesshin, doing intensive sittings, there was this melodrama that I guess was part of my life of, you know, it would be really exhilarating and or else it would be really horrible and painful. And it took a while to kind of get rid of that melodrama and just kind of sit, you know. Mm-hmm. But I think we do produce ourselves or allow the world to produce with us some, you know, trying to get high or just feeling upset and angry and, you know, and so part of our practice is to find that space that it's not boring, but it's kind of it's sort of in the neutral zone sometimes. We don't need to have all the melodrama. It takes a while, I think. I remember Philip Whalen, a friend and Zen teacher and poet, saying in his grumpy, cantankerous way, if it's not boring, it's not Zen. So, you know, finding that middle way that you know, it takes some work, actually, to appreciate that kind of sense where we're not creating excitement, either positive or negative excitement. So, you know, that was just one thought I had. And going back to what Dave was saying about sense of boredom as, in the beginning, as aimlessness, I remember as a early teenager just feeling this sense of boredom, depression, wanting something meaningful to do. And feeling like I didn't have that. And, you know, so the Zen story that you gave and the idea of every day is a good day, seeing what's, you know, one antidote to that is to really study, as you part of what you were talking about, this experience, instead of trying to make it something else or trying to get something else. And that does take some effort.
does. And you reminded me of something, which is my first all-day sitting. I lived through the morning and headed into the afternoon, and there was something about the light and just sitting there that really reminded me of being a kid when we would go to my great-grandmother's house, and you know, there were no toys and there was truly nothing to do, and it just nothing, you know, you just sit there and watch them like set the table for the next meal, and I remember crying through the whole afternoon because it was just like, yuck, I don't want to be here. One thing that I read as I was doing a little research for this talk is that children and adolescents, and this maybe speaks to your teenage experience, they really can't work with boredom. They really do become bored because their personalities are not developed enough yet to really be resourceful with that experience. And so they really will get bored. And I wonder if that's maybe something that we carry into adulthood that makes it so hard, is that we have to, you know, live through all these experiences that are, you know, kind of overwhelming, and we don't know what to do when we're kids. And it would be great if you could teach children to, you know, do just that and try to sort of work with boredom. But I don't have children, and I'm not that familiar with small children, but from what I was reading, it sounds like they're really just not capable of doing that. And so it is, in a way, maybe a vestige of our childhood that we do have to learn how to work with and deal with as adults to you know, really fully appreciate our life and make something, bring some meaning to that experience. So thanks.
I'm glad you said that about children. I was thinking experiences.
Oh, yeah.
When I teach, and what Doug said about you can see the room get bored, that's what teaching is. And I almost feel like teaching, I'm sometimes I feel like I'm tricking the kids into learning. Like I'm excited about something, but then I kind of sneak in some learning there. But I think that's a different kind of boredom, because I was thinking of, it seems to me that it's a little more real. It's a little more, it's not, I don't think it's as much of like a mind cycle that I get when I get bored. Because I don't think that they're, I don't know, maybe they are, insert, but I think that it's more of just kind of being present with what they're feeling. I don't know. I haven't had questions out yet, because that's what I was thinking almost through you. I was listening to your talk as well, but I was thinking, well, how does this play out in children?
Yeah, maybe it's that they lack the capacity to really observe themselves, the way that adults can also lack that capacity, but the way, you know, it can be developed.
Well, and I was reading this book by Robert Aitken. He just had there's a bunch of little teeny, like, paragraph things, and one of them was called Zazen is Not for Children. And he said, I used to think that 25 was the time to start during Zazen. Now I'm thinking it's more like 35. which I'm not 35 yet, so dang it. But then he said his teacher's wife used to say, Zazen is not for children. They should go out and play. And I kind of feel like that is their Zazen, I guess.
Playing Zazen, or playing meditation.
Yeah.
I like that. Thanks. Nathan?
Nancy, what you said about children not having the capacity to observe themselves. I know John Cage, the composer, he once said, you know, a lot of people find my music boring, but my music isn't boring. You know, if you're bored, you just found a way to be bored. And I think children, that's part of what you said with children, not being able to observe themselves, not being able to observe that the boredom is actually their own activity, rather than something out there.
Yeah. That does kind of bring back that distinction between something as being inherently boring and me as being bored.